ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On the program today, residents of the remote outback community of Papunya launch legal action against the Northern Territory government for allegedly failing to provide climate-safe housing.
We deserve to live in a better and healthy home.
What is unhealthy at the homes now? What does it feel like to live there?
It's really hot. The climate, it changed a bit differently. It's really hotter than before.
And we find out about the aviation tradition of short snorters. Yeah, you heard me right. Short snorters.
And so we actually have one in the collection here, which is nearly 4 metres long.
Short snorters. You're going to find out all about them on Australia Wide today. I'm Sinead Mangan, and as I said, this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. In the remote outback community of Papunya, where scorching daytime temperatures regularly reach about 40 degrees, residents are launching legal action against the Northern Territory government for allegedly failing to provide climate-safe housing. Elsie Lang has this story.
What is it like inside the houses when it's summer, in the middle of summer?
It's really like, it's like an oven or microwave, like it's cooking you from the inside.
In remote Papunya or Wurrumbi community in central Australia, residents say they're not just feeling the strain from the heat, it's making them sick. Papunya resident Ashley Robertson says the community, 250 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs, does not have adequate public housing to deal with the ever-increasing impacts of climate change.
It affects the younger generation, and now the elderly are getting old and the weather is changing.
He and his neighbours say they've been failed by their landlord, the NT government, and they're taking legal action in the federal court, filed on Monday, alleging the government has failed in its duty as a landlord to protect tenants from extreme heat. Mr Robertson is the lead plaintiff in the landmark legal case, one of four residents backed by the Human Rights Law Centre.
We deserve to live in a better and healthy home.
What is unhealthy at the homes now? What does it feel like to live there?
It's really hot. The climate, it changed a bit differently. It's really hotter than before. Heat is really bad now.
Mr Robertson, along with co-claimants Candy Nelson, Stanley Roberts and Nerida Roberts, live across three houses in the community in homes with faults the Law Centre says are replicated across Papunya. Human Rights Law Centre senior lawyer Jack McLean says the law firm surveyed the entire Papunya community and found thousands of faults, including broken air conditioners, lack of shading, poor insulation and thermal inefficiency, making it impossible to keep homes cool. Mr McLean says Papunya residents have reported major health problems from the heat too.
Tell me a little bit about how extreme heat can disproportionately impact the most vulnerable people in a community.
Extreme heat kills more people in Australia than all other natural disasters combined. That's floods, bushfires, cyclones. We know that elders and young people are at particular risk of the exposure to extreme heat. Community members tell us that their kids are having seizures, they're getting nosebleeds, they're blacking out due to dehydration. Elders are struggling to sleep at night because of the heat.
Mr McLean says the Northern Territory government is the only landlord in Papunya, meaning there is a lack of housing options for residents, and maintenance can take months.
People don't have the choice to shop around. There is no other game in town. They're paying rent to the Northern Territory government because it's their only option. And the Northern Territory government isn't upholding their end of the bargain by providing a safe, livable house in exchange for that rent.
We're here in the middle of Papunya community. I grew up all around this area.
Emerging community leader Jared Anderson is proud of his community, its long legacy as the birthplace of the Western Desert Art Movement and where the Wurrumbi band strummed their first guitars means a lot to him. He says the housing issues in Papunya are seen across NT remote communities, in places that are often out of sight and out of mind to the broader Australian community.
I think it's important for people to understand what we go through season by season, you know, just when it gets hot, it gets really hot. And when it gets cold, it gets really cold. The government's let us down for a long time, and it's time to act. The time for acting is now, so we want healthy homes. That's what we're asking for.
The Papunya case follows previous legal action on housing brought by remote NT communities Jinjipura Senator Teresa, Loramba and Gunbalanya, with landmark outcomes that cancelled rental debts and triggered court-ordered compensation to residents. The Human Rights Law Centre's Jack McLean says he hopes this case, fought by these remote residents, sets a benchmark for public housing across Australia.
By setting a precedent that the NT government needs to provide climate-safe housing for everyone in Papunya, that could potentially influence the standard for other governments around the country. People are just trying to get by here, and the Northern Territory government's making that really hard.
Elsie Lang with that story. And the Northern Territory government was approached for a response, but has not yet provided comment. Food charities across Queensland say rising costs and surging demand are threatening their ability to stay open. As Janelle Shorthouse reports, some long-running regional services have already been forced to close.
In a busy kitchen on the Sunshine Coast, volunteers are working to keep a food charity running under growing pressure.
Doing some stewed fruit.
We are very good at doing loaves and fishes.
We don't have a fixed menu, so we can just cook with everything, and depending on what we get, we can just create different meals.
And how many meals are you making now?
13,000 a month. Yeah, we used to do 15,000 a month, but ingredients have gone up so much.
Cost of living, of course, went up for everyone, so that's why we cut down the numbers of meat that we were producing.
Across Queensland, that pressure is playing out in different ways. And for some communities, it's already having real consequences. In Gympie, a long-running food charity, Victory Care, has closed after 16 years, with rising transport and operating costs proving too much. Further west, in Mundubbera, Pastor Alan Coburn from Life Care says the same pressures are affecting both families and the services supporting them.
We're just trying to do the best we can, and you know, it'd be great to have that extra financial support either from government or private groups that would support such needs. And the other thing too is that makes it difficult for us with funding is we've been knocked back from grants or funding because we're so far away. Even loans to purchase a new building. We won't fund that because you're in a rural area or you're just too far away, you're not in the city, which is annoying. Government funding is difficult as well because, you know, we don't necessarily qualify because we want to purchase food product, which is a disposable product, as opposed to an asset.
In North Queensland, similar pressures are being reported. A Food Bank Queensland report last year found nearly half of households in Townsville were food insecure. In Cairns, Mission Australia's Hambledon House says requests for emergency food relief are rising as more working families struggle to cover the basics. But back at Urban Angels, the meal packing continues. What sort of increases have you seen with the amount of people approaching you?
10 referrals a day sometimes, which is high.
Especially from December on, we had so many new requests for help. And with kids going back to school in January, we had so many more families reaching out saying that they were doing tough and asking for help. And I feel those last 3 months has been a big increase.
All of our deliveries are at capacity now, so we're increasingly getting people to come to pick up from the kitchen.
How could your job here be helped?
More money. If they want to volunteer, we would be very happy to have them. And if they want to donate money or ingredients, that would be great as well. That's what we rely on. We would be able to make more food and deliver to more people.
In a statement, Australian Charities Not-for-Profit Commission Commissioner Sue Woodward says charities are reporting increasing demand for essential services. A Queensland Council of Social Service report found most organisations are seeing increased demand, with many unable to meet current needs. Larger organisations are also under pressure to maintain their services. Gateway Care Managing Director Tom Liu says changes to supermarket supply and rising costs are having a significant impact. He says despite a $5 million pre-election funding commitment from the Queensland Government in 2024, the funding still hasn't arrived.
So we still haven't seen a cracker, and here we are in 2026 and we're still waiting. We're still going through bureaucracy and red tape and some of the issues, but that will just is to help our operational costs. A big component of what we do at Gateway as well is we rescue food from other agencies, food suppliers, primary producers, and so we actually collect 2 million kilos of food product that would normally end up in landfill. We take that in and that goes into our no-cost distribution to families.
But they don't want people to feel they shouldn't ask for help.
Sometimes people are ashamed to reach out to us, but I always say that think of us like the old-fashioned neighbour who rocks up with a casserole in a time of crisis.
How lovely. Our reporter Janelle Shorthouse with that story, and she was chatting there with Birgit Soden and Marta Refo from the Urban Angels charity.
ABC Australia Wide.
In New South Wales northwest, conservation biologists are wading through knee-deep mud, trying to save dozens of turtles who've had no choice but to bury themselves. The turtles' habitat, the Gwydir wetlands near Moree, is drying out, so the endangered species dig themselves into mud to lay dormant until water returns to the muddy waterholes. Biologists say the wetlands is facing an ecological disaster after Water New South Wales recently halted environmental water inflows to the area. Genevieve Blandin de Chalain has this story.
She's huge, mate. She's got to be a 7-kilo-er.
In the dried-up Gwydir wetlands, about 70 kilometres west of Moree in New South Wales northwest, Dr. Debbie Bauer and her team of conservation biologists have been digging up turtles who've buried themselves into mud to lay dormant until water returns.
We have been thigh-deep, at times waist-deep in the mud, very slow-going, losing our shoes and wading in this sloppy, algae-infested mud hole. You walk along very slowly and occasionally you hit something hard. Sometimes it's a pig skull, sometimes it's a dead carp, and sometimes it's a turtle. So we've been trying to rescue the turtles out of the waterhole so they don't die.
The once thriving ecosystem, now reduced to sludge, sits in the northern part of the Murray-Darling Basin, the country's largest river system. The Gwydir Wetlands is one of Australia's designated Ramsar sites and is listed as a wetland of international importance protected under the Ramsar Convention. Recently, Water New South Wales halted environmental water flows to the wetland following threatened legal action from a nearby landholder over inundation at their property. But there are concerns about the harm the drying wetlands will have on local wildlife. The New South Wales Department of Climate Change, Energy, the Environment and Water says the wetlands are crucial for the biological and ecological functioning of the Murray-Darling Basin bioregion.
Historically, the Gwydir wetlands did not dry regularly. So when you look back at the water data, you can see that it's a permanent refuge site. And that's reflected in the species that we find there. We find the Murray River turtle and the broad-shelled turtle, which are generally species that occur very close to the river or in permanent sites. So this is the first time that I've seen turtles buried into the mud awaiting their fate. Certainly the broad-shelled turtle and the Murray River turtle are not highly adapted to being in dry environments, and it will depend on how hot it is and how much water is left in the mud, but I think it would be a matter of weeks to months.
While there is no way to know how many turtles are still buried beneath the surface, those that have been rescued are being taken to the Taronga Western Plains Zoo in Dubbo. Dr. Bauer says low water levels have also led to a large-scale fish kill, and nearby animals like kangaroos are being forced to move to private land in search of food and water. She says the desperate scene could be easily fixed by releasing water from Copeton Dam, about 200 kilometres away.
Our state and our Commonwealth government buy water which they put aside for the purposes of the environment, but it is then Water New South Wales that operationally releases that water. And at the moment, the state government, the New South Wales government, is refusing to actually release the water, even though they have been asked to by the people who manage the water.
Water Minister Rose Jackson says Water New South Wales temporarily suspended the water flows due to a liability risk associated with nearby private land being inundated. Greens MP Kate Fairman said she was informed water delivery to parts of the Gwydir wetland system had been stopped in March 2026.
The environmental water was there. It's in the system. It's in the dam. It's been purchased. It should have made its way to the wetlands. Let's remember in terms of legal action that the government actually has legal responsibility for the health of these wetlands. They've got international obligations because these wetlands, you know, Ramsar listed. They host many international migratory bird species. They're very, very important. And it's almost one of the whole reasons that the Murray-Darling Basin Plan exists in the first place, was to ensure that water is shared equally to a point that those critical ecosystems, like this wetland specifically, are protected. The tragedy of this is that water is there, and it was a deliberate action to pull the gates down, if you like, to stop the flow of water that has led to this, what is really a national environmental catastrophe.
In a statement, Minister Jackson said the state government is working to resume the inflows while managing the inundation of neighbouring properties.
And thanks to Genevieve Blandin de Chalain for that story. Stories of Australia's military past are being rediscovered through graffitied banknotes. The tradition of short snorters began as a bush pilot custom, but was later adopted by defence personnel during the First World War. Jess Norton has the story.
A crumpled up banknote can tell a thousand stories of service from our defence personnel in what's known as short snorters. As Andy Muir, Assistant Curator at the Australian War Memorial, can explain.
They kind of emerge in the 1930s, and it's sort of a keepsake where people sign money, currency, with their friends before they kind of go on a trip. And sort of, it really sort of became with those, in the 30s, with those transatlantic flights between America and Europe. By sort of the time of the Second World War, they're really popular. They're kind of seen as almost like a good luck charm. So when people are going on trips, they kind of, you know, sign their notes with their friends. They can be a single note, or if that note was filled, they would sort of attach more notes. And so we actually have one in the collection here, which is nearly 4 metres long, which is all these different currencies from around Europe and the Pacific that have all been signed and stuck together.
Warrant Officer Andy McCabe says in Townsville, North Queensland, it's home to one of the country's more rare short snorters that tells the story of crossover between US troops and Australian aviators.
So our particular short snorter is from 1942, a 10-shilling note, which was signed by the fighter pilots from 76 Squadron flying the Kitty Hawks. So they all came here to do their training before heading to PNG to do the Milne Bay conflict. So the story has it that it was signed, and we're not quite sure, some cafe in Townsville. So all these fighter pilots signed it. There's numerous signatures on both sides of the note.
Discovered in the late 80s, the piece of military history now proudly sits at Townsville's RAF Base Heritage Centre.
Back then, some young guy who was interested in what happened during the war, he was in a second-hand shop somewhere in Townsville, and just came across this note and realised it must have significance to what happened here during World War II. We believe he paid about $15 for it from the second-hand shop and then donated it to the Heritage Centre here.
Flight Lieutenant Clive Newton Warne was one of the signatories of the 10-shilling note, and these days his granddaughter Emma Warne not only gets to view the piece of military history, but take flight over some of the same landscapes he once flew.
I've since learned about how much time my grandfather was in Townsville for. We've looked back at some of the photos and actually seen that one of them is him flying across the face of Mount Stewart, which is quite prominent in Townsville, and I've made the same flight almost myself. And to think that he was here like 80 years before me, it's kind of pretty cool because I was pretty young when he died, and I have only a few memories, really.
The practice may have disappeared in the 50s, but a similar tradition of exchanging challenge coins continues today.
I've been in 46 years and I've got numerous coins that have been given to me, and you collect them, and I think that's how they started it back then, by just signing a note, and they were required to keep it. Most units will have a coin they make up that for their unit, and I mean, you don't just give them away willy-nilly, but if someone particularly impresses you, or they've done something nice or whatever, then you can give them a coin and memory of what you did or what they did for you.
RAF Townsville Aviation Heritage Centre Officer in Charge, Warrant Officer Andy McCabe, finishing that story from Jess Naunton. Short snorters, I'd never heard of them before. It's a story with hope at its core, a prison escape more than 10 years in the planning to break free six Irish Fenians detained at Fremantle Prison for their political beliefs. On April 17th, 1876, the Catalpa whaling ship sailed into Perth and the biggest prison break in WA's history took place. 150 years later, and the story still lives on through ancestry and folklore.
A noble Welsh ship and commander, called the Catalpa, they say, sailed into Western Australia and stole six bold Fenians away. For 7 long years they...
When I was 7 years old, I remember it was a rainy day. Kind of snuck up to the attic because I wanted to see what was up there. I was kind of nosy. I found these drawings of a boat, and look at these flags. I went, what are these things doing here? And I went downstairs and I said, Ma, what is this stuff? She goes, I got to get you to talk to your grandfather.
For 7 long years they had spent here, and 7 long years had to stay. For defending their country, old Ireland, and that was they banished away.
Friday the 17th of April marked 150 years since Australia's most daring and successful prison break took place, the Catalpa escape. James Ryan is the great-grandson of George S. Anthony, the captain of the infamous Catalpa, which sailed all the way to Rockingham in Perth South from New Bedford in Massachusetts in 1875.
He was considered a pirate by the British, so he could never go to sea again. He lost everything.
But what motivated a sea captain from the United States of America to help six prisoners in Western Australia? Self-professed historian Peter Murphy says the idea for the mission was sparked by a letter.
We have to go back to 1866, when 62 Fenian prisoners, political prisoners, were actually transported to West Australia and were incarcerated in Fremantle Prison.
One of those men was John Boyle O'Reilly, who escaped on his own years earlier, making his way to Boston in the US, but never forgetting about his fellow Fenians.
He gets a message from one of the Fenian prisoners, and the message is called Voices from the Tomb. They're still incarcerated, six of them, in Fremantle Prison. So O'Reilly and some well-heeled Irish businessmen, they pool the money together, and then basically they buy the Catalpa.
And so a plan is hatched. The Catalpa ship was chosen and purchased for the price of $5,500, roughly $165,000 today. A humble vessel, but sturdy enough to survive iceberg-filled waters and the year-long whaling expedition the crew used as its cover story, leaving the New Bedford port in 1875. The Catalpa sailed for 333 days to the southwest of WA, mooring in Kumbana Bay in Bunbury, 160 kilometres south of Perth.
And they were waiting a message from two spies that were already ensconced in Fremantle. So Captain George Anthony, who was the skipper, he basically sent some cryptic telegrams to the spies in Fremantle.
He had been passing notes to the prisoners, be on your best behaviour, get ready, we've got a boat coming for you. And they then, on the given day, the Fenians were all out in working parties around Fremantle, got them into horse and dray, galloped them down to the beach in Rockingham.
Margot O'Byrne says it's the thrill of the story of the Catalpa that got her hooked on its history. The men rowed the boat out to the waiting Catalpa, battling rough seas and evading the searching authorities for close to 2 days. Finally, under the threat of cannon fire, the Catalpa made it to international waters.
One of the Fenians actually asked Captain Anthony, he said, do you think that we're going to survive the night? And Anthony, to his credit, said, oh yes, I've been out in much worse storms than this. But later he told his biographer, he said, I wouldn't have given a cent for all of our lives there that night.
Defending the country, old Ireland,
And that was they.
The Catalpa has inspired books, plays, and folk songs for 150 years. Peter Murphy says it's the way the story makes people feel which has carried it through history.
They never gave up hope. And I guess probably, you know, where there is life, there's hope.
Comrades, be free.
Thanks to Madigan Landry for that story. And that's Australia Wide for today. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.